All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Judge Allen, and to my right is Judge Toth, and we're here today on the matter of Howard Morgan, Jr. versus David J. Shulkin, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, number 1798. Now, I think, as the parties have been told, the third member of this panel is Judge Sholin, and she's unable to participate in the oral argument today. However, she is going to participate in the consideration and decision of this case. At least that's how what we understand now. And I'm sure that she will get a chance to listen to the oral argument. And I'll disclose something, which is, as Judge Toth and I were just discussing, the questions in the supplemental briefing order were hers, so in large measure. So she's definitely going to be interested in this. So if counsel for both parties would state your appearance for the record.
Zachary Schultz, Justin Chisholm Kilpatrick, on behalf of Mr. Morgan, with me at counsel table is Janet Zimmer, also of the firm.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Sarah Pisino on behalf of the Secretary, and with me at counsel's table is Chris Wallace.
Thanks. So each party is going to have 30 minutes, and I'm assuming you're reserving 10 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Schultz?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You can start whenever you'd like. Thanks.
Thank you, Judge Allen. Good afternoon, Your Honor. And may it please the court. This court in Doucette held that when the record contains evidence that a veteran has a non-audiological type of symptom, the board is required to discuss entitlement to an extra scheduler rating. The board here did not conduct the required extra scheduler analysis. Mr. Morgan asked that the court hold that non-audiological types of symptoms are not contemplated by the diagnostic code as a matter of law, hold that the record does raise entitlements to an extra scheduler evaluation, also as a matter of law, and order the board to analyze whether this veteran has non-audiological symptoms of hearing loss which entitle him to that extra scheduler rating.
Mr. Schultz, I'm just kind of fast forward here to a bit to my question. I know in your supplemental briefing, You offered an argument about how, in a sense, this would be reasonably raised in the record. If I understood correctly, it would be that there would be, in a sense, evidence as to the first prong of Thune, and then it would merely have to suggest for the second prong some type of effect on employment. I just want to fully understand your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, and the basis for the position that Mr. Morgan took in the supplemental pleading comes from the Comer and Roberson line of cases, as well as the language in Thun and Doucette. It is a low bar to trigger an extra scheduler analysis. Whether or not it results in an extra scheduler rating is going to be up to the trier of fact, to the Board of Veterans, to the Board of Veterans Appeals. But in order to raise it, to trigger the analysis, it is a very low bar. So, in a sense, we saw that question as a threshold type of question, and this case as a threshold type of case. What is necessary to start the analysis?
And can I jump in to follow up with that, which is, do you agree that there needs to be whatever quantum of evidence would satisfy the low bar? Okay. Does the evidence have to touch both Thune 1 and Thune 2? In other words, clear evidence of ear pain from a hearing aid. Okay, step one, satisfied. There'd have to, though, then be something in the record that would at least hint at step two?
Yes, Your Honor. Yancey suggests that. So that both prongs would have to be considered together. In this case, both of those parts are satisfied, at least as much for the board to have to offer the analysis.
And how much evidence would be needed, particularly at step two? I mean, what types of things? I know that you couldn't give an exhaustive list, mm-hmm. for example, but what would it be?
Step two would be I'm trying to think about the most extreme case. Well, a notation that the hearing, and this, let's use hearing loss because that's what this case is about. If there's evidence that the hearing loss causes an effect on the occupation, that's enough, which there is in this case. There's the X on a DBQ. We'll use Mr. Morgan's facts. Mr. Morgan was a truck driver, and now he has trouble hearing in traffic.
But, I mean, isn't it? I mean, the problem that I have is with the word verb suggests. I mean, by implication, almost any disability would have an effect on your occupation. I mean, it would sort of basically eliminate any type of requirement for suggesting evidence as to the second prong. I mean, any disability, you could argue, by implication, would have an effect on a person's employment. So I just don't see, I mean, this, in effect, the suggests standard, if you were to call it that, might be so low that it might be really no standard at all. I mean, can you speak to that?
This court recently handed down the Rossi decision, where there was no evidence in the record that there was an occupational effect. And so it does happen. It happens, and I do think that that the evidence does have to suggest an effect on employment or the frequent periods of hospitalization, the other part of 3.321. Your Honor, I disagree. The suggests standard, I don't think, is too low of a bar. There are many cases that this court has wrestled with where there was no indication in the record. The Doucette case, for example. The Doucette case, there was not an indication.
In those cases, the board ruling that this court was reviewing was as to the first prong. So in a sense, the second prong was sort of immaterial to that adjudication. This would be a case where now, if we're saying for the record to reasonably raise this issue, if it need address both prongs, then what would be that second prong? It would have to be something that were at least meaningful enough that we could provide some guidance to the board as, okay, this is how you do it, this is how you wouldn't.
The board would do it whenever an occupation is triggered, or the board in its analysis would have to consider what the veteran did for an occupation. In the hearing loss context, it becomes, I think, a little bit more apparent because hearing loss has such a wide effect on a person's livelihood.
No, exactly. I mean, that speaks to the concern. I mean, it could affect anything.
But specifically in a case like this where a veteran was a truck driver and can't hear in traffic anymore, That is a suggestion that because nobody really ever followed up on this, which is the second part of our brief, which is the Bryant issue, the board hearing officer never did follow up on that. And we are not, Mr. Morgan doesn't ask that the court undertake the extra scheduler evaluation. That's the board's job. It's just that once, and Comer and Roberson really is a low bar, Your Honor. The Federal Circuit was clear in both of those cases that in order to trigger the analysis, it is a suggestion, a competent suggestion.
I mean, if you read the language of 3.321, it is not, at least in terms of the Secretary's own language, described as a low bar. I mean, it's supposed to be in unusual circumstances where the rating schedule is inadequate. And I fear that we would be replacing what would effectively be definite language with pretty much an open-ended swing gate that just sort of required everyone would get extra scheduler in hearing or PTSD, just a variety of contexts. I'm asking if the standard that you propose can actually be interpreted in such a way that it could provide meaningful guidance that wouldn't basically just be the kind of barn doors open and everyone gets it.
Your Honor, it does provide meaningful guidance because, again, it's not necessary, and I think the Secretary does this in his pleading. They're jumping ahead to actually adjudicating the case.
Sure.
In order to trigger the board, if the board had conducted the analysis that Your Honor is conducting, if the board had said, well, here's the suggestion, there's a DBQ that has an X in the box on occupational effect, Mr. Morgan worked as a truck driver.
Sure, no, and I'm tracking that, and I think your argument in this regard is well placed. What I'm saying is there any way they could conduct that analysis and not come to the conclusion that extra schedule analysis was warranted? Meaning, is the analysis such that it's virtual pass-through? Yes, the board would do it, but the result would almost always be the same. Meaning, could they effectively, is there an instance in which they could deny extra schedule analysis in such a way that we could actually affirm it in this court?
If they denied extra schedule analysis after fully developing the record, one of the major problems with this case is that the court is not in a position to really adjudicate the facts because the board didn't conduct any of this. Let's say, Your Honor, that the board did do this, and at the hearing, and this is just a hypothetical, at the hearing, the board member would have asked and said, I see here that you can't hear in traffic. You worked as a truck driver. And the veteran could have easily responded, yes, but that doesn't, and I am, this is just a hypothetical. I don't know what Mr. Morgan was saying. I don't mean to put words in his mouth, so call it veteran X. He could say, yes, I can't hear in traffic, but it's really not a problem. It's not the reason that I stopped being a truck driver. And the board does this analysis all the time in the TDIU context. It's really no different. And Comer was in the TDIU context, for example. It's no different than that. The board needs to do the analysis and ask some follow-up questions. Because what if the question had come back, yes, I can't hear in traffic, and that's the whole reason I can't pursue my livelihood as a truck driver anymore? Well, now we do have to, now the board does have to do an extra scheduler analysis. So, again, just to raise the question is rightfully placed as a low bar, and the board needed to do some follow-up work here. So had that answer come out, or had they sent a letter and pursued their duty to assist and followed it, Your Honor may be in a better position to say, well, you know what? They asked. He said it didn't affect his employment. Good enough. We can all move on.
So can I swing you from step two back to step one? Because, you know, hearing loss is different, as you know, in terms of the rating schedule itself. And let's take the example of the traffic that we're talking about here with Mr. Morgan, or you can make him Veteran X2. That's okay. You keep talking about the fact that, as the record reflects, he had difficulty hearing, and, of course, that was a problem for him in traffic because he was a truck driver. Leaving aside the other evidence, right, marital discord or something, but you'd never get to step two there, right? Because, yes, there's a marked effect on his employment, but the symptom is hearing loss. The hearing loss itself is no worse at step one than if it were somebody who wasn't a truck driver, right? So it isn't a severity of symptom. It's an effect on employment, but an effect on employment that's contemplated by the rating schedule. Are you following that?
I'm following you, Your Honor.
So what would you do with that in this situation? Right, because you're right. We have a checked box here that says impact on employability. That's a pretty easy one to say, okay, we have to think about it. But if it's just because he can't hear in traffic, doesn't Thune 1 box you out?
It wasn't just that he couldn't hear in traffic, Your Honor. It was because it caused safety. It's because it caused safety conditions. A decrease in his safety. That is the step one part of it. He suffers a detriment to his safety. That is not contemplated by 4.85 and 4.86, the pure tone threshold. And I'm using Doucette for this analysis, Your Honor. That's the part. So the part two, I agree that it gets a little bit muddled, but they can be separated. The part one part is the fact that he suffers a detriment to his safety. That takes him outside. So now he's got this symptom, and then you look to step two, does that cause any, does, if we're just going to focus on one
Let me just stop, right? So, but what's interesting is that, and maybe this isn't what the law is, right? But I would think that a symptom is a symptom is a symptom, right? In other words, if in fact this is something that causes a safety problem, it doesn't matter what he does for a living at step one, right? Because once we start to say, well, it causes a safety problem and therefore it's not contemplated because it affects his employment, we've merged step one and two. I mean, that's the trouble that I have with the extra scheduler analysis in this area, is that steps one and two become very convoluted. And so we have some decisions that say, this is a truck driver, so therefore the hearing causes a problem and it's not contemplated. And other situations say, you know, it's a guy who stays home and so it doesn't. And I don't see how that can analytically be correct.
The answer to that question, Your Honor, and I agree with Your Honor, that there that it becomes a tricky proposition. When used broadly. However, again, Your Honor is getting to the part of adjudicating the case. And the board didn't give any analysis upon which we could look and say, well, You know, is that a prong one question or a prong two question? It would probably, it would probably be a little bit easier if the step one and step two analysis didn't muddle, but it is the way that it is the way of VA adjudication, and the board, it's the board's job to unmuddle it. And so once because this is a threshold case, once he did have a safety condition, he was outside of the schedule. And so the board did need to start doing the analysis. Had the board reached the conclusion that the safety issue wasn't really bearing on his employability, we would have a different case. But we're not even there yet, Your Honor, because the board didn't even undertake the Thun analysis and didn't do what it was supposed to do since the Yancey decision. I recognize that this is probably unsatisfactory.
That's okay. I interrupted you. But so how would it work? Let's pretend that instead of a truck driver, we have a hypothetical person. We'll call the person Lawyer X, okay? And so the person has trouble hearing, but at a non-compensable level, okay? The person's a veteran. And they're giving an oral argument to a court. And what they find is they're having trouble hearing what the judges say, which makes them nervous and makes them a less effective advocate. How would that, though, be something where we could immediately say at step one that the rating schedule doesn't contemplate that feeling? In other words, not being able to hear. Because that's just a different example than the truck driver, but that seems to be exactly what the rating schedule contemplates.
But your Honor described nervousness. Put another way, anxiety. That is a non-audiological symptom, and so that is step one. Once, after Doucette, after Thun and Yancey and Doucette and all these, the nervousness that you describe is the step one part of it. Lawyer is nervous. We're outside of the schedule. Step two, does the nervousness cause employment problems or marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization? Step two. I think that the nervousness, Your Honor, is the threshold that takes you outside.
Okay. On a slightly different topic, you know, the Secretary submitted supplemental authority, the regulation that's going to change as of, I think, January 8th.
Yes, Your Honor.
First of all, you agree that that regulation will apply to this case when... I'm telling you, nothing will move fast enough to have a decision by January 8th, so it will still be at the court. So I want to get you on the record about whether you agree that this applies. Whatever it means, it applies.
It is possible that there will be a rule challenge at the Federal Circuit. If that happens...
Hard to imagine, but continue. Yeah.
Please, yes. I imagine that there will be a rule challenge, or I could imagine a world in which there is a rule challenge, and that may delay the effect of this.
So assuming that we don't have a challenge, right, in which case, you know, whatever happens, but it would apply to the case if it goes into effect.
My understanding is it would.
And so just so I get this right in my head, how would it affect Mr. Morgan's particular case?
My understanding, Your Honor, of the change in the regulation is the board would be under an obligation then to not conduct the analysis of the effects of the post-traumatic stress and his other service-connected conditions, the interplay of those with his hearing loss. It would just be the analysis of the hearing loss, since that is the increased rating claim that is the appeal. That's my understanding of the way the regulation is going to work if it becomes implemented. If there are no further questions, I'll...
Before you go, I wanted to also, and this is sort of a follow-up to my earlier question, understand your argument about, in a sense, again, how this is reasonably raised in the record, and your argument versus a credibility determination over and against a competency one, and how, in a sense, things would be raised in the record such that it would be an improper credibility determination. I just wanted to make sure I fully understood your argument on this point.
Yes, Your Honor. The credibility determination is something that the board would have to do in the first instance. The competent evidence is what raises the issue, what raises, what triggers the threshold analysis.
How is this a credibility determination?
It's not. In this particular case, I don't believe there is a credibility determination to be had by the court. Upon remand, should we be successful in the court? Upon remand, the Board of Veterans Appeals would have to take into account the credibility of the evidence. It would have to do that in any case. That is the point of our answer to the court's question.
Are you saying it sort of operates, and I'm blanking on the name of the case, but you'll probably know it off the top of your head, the provision that says indicating nexus for what triggers the duty for a medical exam?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it that type of thing that you're doing, something in which the board only needs to have something before it that would be competent evidence to indicate something, triggering the medical exam, and then we deal with credibility and weight of the evidence later? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. The Secretary respectfully requests that the Court affirm the Board's December 8, 2016 decision for the following two reasons. First, it must be presumed that the rating schedule adequately compensates for the disability in question. Appellant bears the burden of proof and persuasion to demonstrate otherwise, which he has not done so in this case. And second, the law is clear that the Board need only address issues that are properly raised before it, either explicitly or reasonably. Appellant did not explicitly raise the issue of extra-scheduler consideration and fails to demonstrate that the record reasonably raises any evidence that would trigger an extra-scheduler analysis. Your Honors, under 38 U.S.C. 1155, Congress delegated authority to the Secretary to adopt and apply a schedule of rating disabilities under the guiding principle that it must be based on average impairment of earning capacity. In doing so, in the implementing regulation 38 CFR 4.1, the Secretary stated that the rating schedule is a guide for evaluating disabilities and that generally it is to be considered adequate. Thereby, we have the presumption that unless demonstrated otherwise, the rating schedule is adequate to compensate for the disability in question. And indeed, it is only in rare circumstances, VA has stated, where there is exceptional or an unusual disability picture with related factors such as marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization.
Didn't the whole genesis of this begin with effectively a VA general counsel's interpretation, which sort of said that determination is whether something's contemplated or not? Meaning it's no longer just the objective language of that reg. It's sort of a VA interpretation that's sort of been taken by this court to be the way that we now officially look into what that language means.
Your Honor, the language of 4.1 or the language of 3.321?
Just both of them. I mean, 3.321, sure. And then how it factors out as if it's contemplated, and then we look at, different DCs.
Correct, Your Honor. We would ask that the court look at the overall, this is like the overarching foundation on which the rating schedule is built, which is to compensate for average impairment of earning capacity, and that the Secretary recognizes that there may be these rare circumstances where the rating schedule is not adequate, but the choice of the Secretary on how to compensate for certain disabilities, that is a policy decision that the Secretary has made and that should be afforded deference. And Your Honor,
I just want to push you on this, just so I fully understand. I mean, my understanding is the extent, the official interpretation is still the 1996 interpretation, right? Is that the agency's position that whether this is, if it's contemplated by the diagnostic code? And the agency has not offered any other, hasn't tried to revise it or anything in light of all these cases that have come since?
Yes, in terms of an official general counsel opinion, yes, Your Honor, but the Secretary also believes that he has represented in litigation before this court the
understanding that this is truly only for rare circumstances, for exceptional
or unusual. That's not, I mean, that's not entitled to deference. Or, I mean, that's, it might be nice for something to say, but it's not something that our court would have to kind of accord any kind of our deference or anything to. It's an official, you know, published notice and comment, the whole bit.
Sure, Your Honor. Insofar as that the requirement for it to be exceptional or unusual, that is language in the regulation, so yes, there would be deference to that aspect of it.
Well, no, I mean, deference to the VA's particular interpretation. I mean, I know the code's published, and you know, that's it is what it is. I'm saying a particular interpretation of what, you know, how the unusual circumstance, or how this would mean, is still the 1996 one. I mean, we can't get around the contemplated language.
Sure, Your Honor, yes. And the Secretary believes that what he is saying today is consistent with that interpretation. And, Your Honors, then because it's presumed that the rating schedule is adequate, we would have to have something either explicitly raised, which has not been done so in this case, or reasonably raised. And both this Court and the Federal Circuit have made explicitly clear that if there's no evidentiary support in the record, there's no reason for the Board to address or consider such a theory. And indeed, in Doucette, the Court stated, the Board certainly does not have a duty to engage in an extra-scheduler analysis in every single hearing loss case. If the rating schedule contemplates the functional effects of decreased hearing and difficulty understanding speech in an everyday environment, and the evidence only suggests that, then the Board does not need to engage in an extra-scheduler analysis.
So, sticking with step one of Thuen for a second.
Sure.
Right, I find that to be sort of really slippery, right? It's sort of like I feel like I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about it, I feel like I've gotten it, and then much like holding a slippery otter, it squeezes right out of my hands, okay? Because on the one hand, everything associated with hearing loss is associated with what Doucette said the rating schedule contemplates. Absolutely everything, right? Because from extra wax in your ear all the way down to social isolation, you can tie it back in a but-for to that you can't hear, right? So it seems like that can't be what it means. But on the flip side, any evidence or evidence in a lot of records could be said to reasonably raise, as my hypothetical with Mr. Stoltz did, nervousness of the lawyer, right? And so it almost seems like in the context of hearing loss, these things are all going to be decided at step two, because unless the court were to say it's all hearing loss top to bottom, it seems to me we get to the marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization. At least that's how I'm thinking about it, because I can't think of another way to separate out step one, and I wondered your thoughts.
We would agree with that, Your Honor. The Court and Yancey spoke to this. They said step one talks about symptoms and step two talks about effects. And really what appellant is describing here are the effects of how his hearing loss disability affects him personally. The underlying symptom here is still what the Court in Doucette and then more recently in Rossi stated is complaints of difficulty hearing. And it all ties back ultimately to that, which is contemplated and compensated for by the scheduler rating that he is receiving.
So I don't mean to stick on this, but
sure.
I thought at the beginning you were sort of agreeing with that sort of thing I had laid out, but by the end, right, it was back to, but it's all hearing, and I'm not criticizing you because that's what I mean about the slippery otter, right? By the end, the animal is gone, right? And because it seems to me that in most situations, you have something that's let's just take this, which is very common in these cases. I know you know this. I have to turn the TV up, and I have to turn the TV up, and it really annoys my spouse, and he or she gets up and leaves the room. I can look at that, and I can say that doesn't reasonably raise the issue because it's all about not hearing. But I can equally look at that and say, well, that's not really about hearing because it's led to what's going to be a fight for the rest of the day between this married couple, and that's different, right? And I just can't see a way to separate out those two unless we were to say it's all hearing from top to bottom.
Well, Your Honor, I think this is why we set forth the foundation that we have to look at this case, which is that the presumption is that the rating schedule is adequate. Really, we have to have this exceptional or unusual disability picture. We have to have severity and symptomatology that is not contemplated by the rating schedule in order for extra scheduler consideration to possibly apply. And I think that's potentially the difficulty Your Honor is experiencing right now, because the rating schedule is so comprehensive in contemplating for complaints of hearing that if the ultimate symptomatology that appellant is complaining of is difficulty hearing or difficulty understanding speech, that is contemplated by the rating schedule.
So, but I mean, how then would we, so when I write something, I try, I got lots of audiences, but one of them is the board member. If I'm going to be sending something back, I want to provide the board member with guidance, whether they agree or disagree, about what they did wrong or what they should do in the future. How would I instruct a board member in the hypothetical that I gave, which isn't a hypothetical, I think it might be part of this case, right? I have to turn the TV up and draw, it makes my spouse leave the room. How do I tell the board member how to distinguish that from being it's just about hearing and that being about something else like marital discord?
Well, Your Honor, I think that presumes that marital discord is potentially a symptom, which it's not, right? We're talking about marital discord is really an effect of somebody describing how that disability affects them, and that we still think that goes to the second question of Thun. And to, if I may, Your Honor, specifically go into the specific issues that were raised here, I'll start with social isolation. Appellant asserts that he has social isolation due to hearing loss, but Your Honors, the record does not attribute, not only is there no evidence attributing social isolation to hearing loss, there's actually no evidence of social isolation at all in this record. What we have is appellant reported he has numerous good and active social relationships with his friends, with his band members, with his siblings, with his children, with his father. Certainly nothing to suggest that this is a veteran that has near to complete lack of social contact. To the extent appellant is trying to suggest that merely stating that he cannot hear certain conversations or participate in certain conversations with certain people, I believe his preacher and his grandkid in this circumstance, that that's sufficient to raise social isolation, that would certainly, that can't be the case, Your Honor, because then that would really be to suggest that either every single veteran that has hearing loss suffers from social isolation, and then either that has to be contemplated by the rating schedule, otherwise every veteran would be exceptional, which also can't be the case. And then turning to marital discord, similarly here, we have a specific factual scenario here where appellant's poor relationship with his wife is attributed to being remarried multiple times over a 43-year period. It is something that is already explicitly compensated for under his 50% PTSD rating, which contemplates difficulty with social relationships and social impairment. And there's absolutely, again, no suggestion here in the record that he has marital discord attributable to hearing loss.
Let's just assume there was, right? Because I'm curious, because again, and I understand why this happens, because it happens with me too. At the beginning of your answer, you said that the marital discord I hypothesized, there was no evidence that it had any effect in step two, right? But that, by definition, takes us through step one, saying there was something about that isn't contemplated at step one. You see, the problem I'm having is I think the line Doucette drew in theory and from 100,000 feet makes perfect sense. I think it is impossible to actually draw those distinctions in the hearing loss context unless we essentially say it's all hearing, or you know what, it's not all hearing and it's all going to be done at step two. And that's what I'd love your views on.
I think I hear what you're saying, Your Honor. The thing is, Thun doesn't necessarily have to be a sequential step, so we're not saying by saying that marital discord is really an effect of hearing loss, we're not saying that you've already made it past step one, that you've demonstrated an exceptional or unusual disability picture. Our position still is that when the underlying symptomatology is a complaint of difficulty hearing, that is something that is contemplated by the rating schedule. And I understand, Your Honors, the difficulty potentially in applying this, but again, that brings us back to the idea that VA's disability compensation system compensates for average impairment of earning capacity. We're not necessarily, Thun makes very clear that it's a faulty proposition that the schedule is not adequate unless it compensates for the individualized income lost, right? So we're looking at averages here, and naturally that means that some veterans are going to be overcompensated, some are going to be undercompensated, but there is no appreciable difference between a veteran who can't hear his spouse to a veteran who can't hear the television to a veteran who can't hear the telephone, because the underlying symptomatology, and that's what we're concerned about here, is a difficulty hearing, complaint of a difficulty hearing. And so that doesn't rise to the level of something exceptional or unusual to give rise to an extra scheduler consideration. Now, Your Honor, certainly we could potentially envision maybe a factual scenario where marital discord being possibly an effect of a disease or disability could, depending on the facts, of course, suggest maybe secondary service connection for something else, like a psychiatric disability. The faulty premise is that we cannot automatically assume that it brings us into the extra scheduler realm. The presumption is that the rating schedule is adequate. The presumption is that the rating schedule is comprehensive, and that somewhere in the rating schedule, these things can be compensated for. And specifically in appellant's case, that is absolutely the case. He is receiving a 50% rating for PTSD that contemplates any sort of difficulty in maintaining and establishing work and social relationships.
So are there any things that Doucette used some interchangeable language to describe, sometimes symptoms, sometimes functional effects, sometimes functional impairment? Are there any things that you would say do fit in the bucket of things that wouldn't be contemplated, and so if there were evidence raising this in the record, it would require a discussion at least at step one? In other words, I'm trying to think of, are there categories of things that are, some of them are easy to deal with and some of them are harder?
Well, I think this brings us back to ENC saying that symptoms are part of your analysis in step one. So that's when we look at more so the symptoms. And then in terms of now looking at functional effects or then functional impairment, that's the second question of Thun. That's where we look and see, okay, what has this veteran described are the functional effects of his disability? Does it rise to the level of what VA understands to be this term of art, functional impairment, which is really something indicating that ultimately there's occupational functioning impairment. For extra scheduler purposes, we measure that by looking to see if there's marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization.
So, what about something like this, that maybe we could say there are subsets of things, symptoms, I'll use the air quotes to deal with this. Some of them are physical. Right? So we could put, you know, the tenderness associated with your ear because of the hearing loss, because of a hearing aid, or waxy buildup, or believe it or not, there was a case about sweaty ears. That would be one thing. Those seem easier to distinguish from I can't hear. And then maybe on the other end we have social issues, right? Social isolation, marital discord. And maybe we should treat them differently than the physical things. In other words, I'm trying to categorize in a way that we could actually provide guidance to the board to help distinguish in the record. Because really the fundamental problem here is not when Mr. Stoltz says to the board, hey, I want you to consider extra scheduler, because then the board has to look because it's been raised. The real problem is when nobody says anything, but the law says in certain magical circumstances the board has to independently do it. So we got to be able to give the board something, because there's always going to be evidence of hearing loss in a hearing loss case.
Right.
So would something like that work, maybe?
Potentially. I apologize. I don't know if I've had enough time to really think about, you know, separating the physical and the social. But I think, Your Honor, what we mean when we are requiring there to be evidence that reasonably raises it, sufficient for the board to address it, we're talking about there really needs to be some sort of competent evidence, right? Appellant could be competent to assert, to explicitly raise it himself, but we could also have evidence in the record, let's say for just purposes of example, that a medical examiner says this veteran has hearing loss and he also now has extreme ear pain as a result, and that's something that I don't typically see in veterans that just have hearing loss. For example, something like that really would be sufficient then, of course, for the board to know that this issue is reasonably raised. But
since would that be different than if the examiner said, I examined this person and they have hearing loss, and they are very, very sad, more than I usually see with somebody with hearing loss? And I'm not pushing you. I'm actually literally trying to distinguish between he's got really bad physical pain in his ears and he's got really bad emotional pain in his head because of the hearing problem.
And I think that's a... I think in those cases, potentially what an examiner is suggesting sometimes when they in those hypotheticals, really is potentially the possibility of secondary service connection. I mean, really, I think we still have to keep going back to the premise that the rating schedule is comprehensive and the presumption that it is adequate and can be adequate to compensate for all possible disabilities. So in those scenarios, Your Honor, it's potential that that's enough to suggest the possibility of secondary service connection, not necessarily that it is extra scheduler, that we've been presented with something so exceptional and unusual that's completely outside of the rating schedule.
You know, I want to follow up on a question Judge Allen asked to the appellant about the effect of the intervening reg change by VA. You know, how, in your sense, how do you see that playing forward in terms of this landscape?
Well, Your Honor, we previously had the language from Yancey that says that Johnson doesn't really change anything in terms of it has to be reasonably raised and all the elements of Thun have to be met. So even if we still had a collective impact landscape, that would be the law. But insofar as this final rule, we do believe it, as Judge Allen pointed out, it applies to cases that are pending effective January 8th, 2008, so very likely this case. And in those situations, what it tells us is that there is no combined extra scheduler effect. We're just looking at the hearing loss disability itself. And in fact, this is supported by the idea that if there is any sort of combined effect, it's already compensated by the schedule, by appellant's combined rating here of 60%. He has 50% for his PTSD and 10% for his hearing loss, and he has a combined rating which already acknowledges that he has multiple service-connected disabilities and they have some sort of combined effect.
So does the new reg play any sort of flipped role? Here's what I mean, right? You said earlier in response to one of our questions that the marital isolation or the marital discord, you know, there's this PTSD part that's dealing with that. Does the Secretary sort of have to take the bitter with the sweet in terms of this new regulation, and since it's saying absolutely no combined extra scheduler, that when we're doing a regular extra scheduler analysis, we don't consider the other service-connected disability at all for that?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, because, again, he already obviously has a combined scheduler rating of 60%, which contemplates that he has multiple service-connected disabilities. And we are still saying that the law was still clear that Yancey says that Johnson would have to be reasonably raised, and which means that an exceptional or unusual collective impact would have to be reasonably raised. That doesn't mean that we don't look at the fact that he is compensated for any social impairment by his PTSD, because by virtue of that, we're saying that it's not exceptional or unusual. He's already being compensated for it, and there's nothing beyond that. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, actually, very quickly, in response to something that my colleague said as for the hearing officer testimony, the suggestion by appellant that the hearing officer would have needed to basically pre-adjudicate the claim and determine that a higher scheduler rating wasn't warranted and suggest that appellant provide extra scheduler evidence, that's simply not supported by the law. What the hearing completed, which was to elicit information about appellant's current severity of his hearing loss disability. They asked the veteran to describe how he believed his hearing had worsened. An appellant provided that description and that information. There was no responsibility for the hearing officer to go back in through the record and basically pre-adjudicate the claim and try to determine if he should suggest to appellant that he submit evidence to demonstrate that his claim is exceptional or unusual. And if there are no further questions, Your Honor, the Secretary respectfully requests that the Court affirm the Board's December 8, 2016 decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stoltz.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by clarifying one point. The Secretary kept saying throughout her presentation, Secretary's counsel kept saying that symptoms and that effects were a step two analysis under Thun. Symptoms and effects are both contained in the step one of the Thun analysis, which is important in this context because with Judge Allen, with your line of questioning, the effects of the hearing loss in this case are what does trigger an analysis because he has effects that are outside of the audiological testing described in the diagnostic code. The other thing that, and this was throughout the pleadings, I would contend that the Secretary is, again, adjudicating the case. There was a lot of analysis, good analysis, fine analysis, that the Secretary has provided about this case. The problem is that they're doing it right now in front of the court, and they're speculating on an incomplete record. The board has to conduct this analysis, and they didn't do any of it. There's a low threshold, a low trigger point, at which an extra-scheduler analysis should be conducted by the Board of Veterans Appeals. And this dovetails into what we were saying about Bryant. Mr. Morgan doesn't ask for a pre-adjudication. It seems simple, especially after Bryant, and because there is a regulation on point. The evidence of record has non-audiological symptoms and effects for Mr. Morgan. And there is no follow-up question to that whatsoever. It's not that the hearing officer or that the board has to award an extra scheduler evaluation here. It is that under the law, the board has to conduct this analysis. And the discussion today trying to adjudicate this case is premature. It should be sent back to the Board of Veterans Appeals with an instruction that it conduct this analysis and do it correctly in accordance with Thun, Yancey, and the other extra scheduler cases.
Mr. Stoltz, if I understand correctly, so the hearing officer, right, has a duty to fully explain the issues and then suggest any evidence that might be favorable and how to get it. So basically, I mean, with hearing loss, which, you know, Judge Allen's described as slippery, and I think that's right, under the easiest of circumstances, basically the hearing officer would be required in every case to say, hey, you know, you've alleged this and this, this and this, so if it's infected your employment or you've been hospitalized by it, go get evidence of that and bring it back to us. Is that what you're saying? That would be effectively, you know, you would discharge his duty or she would discharge your duty that way?
Yes, Your Honor. Especially in a case like this where the veteran and his wife were offering testimony as to the effects of the hearing loss, and they were beginning to describe non-audiological symptoms and effects, which again is the step one part, symptoms and effects. They began discussing that, and the evidence of record has evidence of this. It would, I imagine, and I would never presume to speak for the court, but there has been a struggle, and I do understand it, that the board needs some guidance on how to adjudicate these cases. But the board did itself no favor here because it never developed this record. So there's no way for the court to really answer the question because the board hasn't conducted this analysis in the first instance. Again, it's a low threshold. And because there are non-audiological symptoms and effects in Mr. Morgan's case, the board needed to conduct an extra schedule analysis, not just simply dismiss it.
So what I'm going to say now isn't meant directed at lawyers in a negative way. But the problem, as I said with Secretary's counsel, we don't run into these problems when somebody actually raises this before the board because either the board does an analysis or it doesn't, and if it doesn't, it's easy to say you had the argument. But where these come up, and I know you know this, is that we have a pile of evidence before the board. Nobody raises the extra scheduler point. And then on appeal to this court, lawyers doing their job take the evidence and say, well, yes, I know that sounds like he just can't hear the TV, but really what that means is there's trouble in the marriage, and that was clear, right? And I really don't know how we can instruct the board how to then take these things that are on the, I'm going to call the social end of the spectrum, as opposed to my ears hurt, okay? And not say, in every situation where that's present, step one is going to be met. Or say, essentially, listen, that was a great line in theory, but we simply cannot operationalize it. Because I can't, I don't know what to tell the board if the evidence is I can't hear the TV and my wife leaves the room. To say, that is evidence of an effect that is separate from the rating schedule.
It is evidence, but Your Honor, it is evidence of an effect that's outside of the rating schedule because of the way the rating schedule is. The hearing loss rating schedule is a strict one. It's beeps and pure tone decibel loss. The Secretary wrote that regulation. That is the way that the Secretary compensates hearing loss on the schedule. The extra scheduler evaluation is to a court justice. I don't know that Your Honor would agree that if Your Honor had a case before him if the board said turning up the TV, sure, it's an effect, but it's non-compensable, and oh, by the way, he doesn't meet step two. That would be a very different case. Your Honor may very well be right. It may be too far afield. But the fact is the board hasn't conducted any of that analysis here at all, so Your Honor can't adjudicate it today. It's just a matter of what the board needs to discuss and what the board needs to weigh and the information that the board needs to convey to veterans. The diagnostic code for hearing loss has been recognized in several cases as being a very strict diagnostic code. It doesn't account for a lot. And so the extra scheduler analysis becomes so vital. And the board failing to conduct any type of analysis or attempt to flesh out the record in any way is the error in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, thank you. So this case, Morgan, will be submitted, and the court will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.